as I wait, heart of God.
Hi, guys, we're this week David is going to be preaching for us. So we've reversed our roles, and I'm going to be, David's going to be reading the questions and I'm going to be responding. This is the last of our series in passage by passage through the Gospel of Matthew. The Sunday after this is Palm Sunday, and then we have Easter Sunday, and then we'll be returning to this Gospel of Matthew after that. So this is the last of those of this particular part of the sequence.
We'll be coming back in pretty short order, but
we're going to continue giving you growth group questions so that, I mean, if you wanted to take the 2 weeks around Easter off, then of course you're welcome to do so. But we will keep producing questions for you so that you can keep going should you wish to do so.
Well, that brings us to our first question, which is a familiar one now. We've called it close reading. It goes like this. After praying for God to enlighten your mind, read through Matthew 5:21-32 a couple of times, slowly. Look for these three things. A light bulb. Now, a light bulb is something that shines from the passage, something that draws your attention. A question mark, something difficult to understand. And lastly, an arrow as a personal application. Share the results with your group.
Now, of course, you know, guys, you don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. It's not a rule that, you know, if you want to go straight to question two, you're welcome to do so. I mean, I think people have different certainly our growth group has really enjoyed doing these things. But if you don't, or you find, or you'd like a change, then go straight to question two. It's fine.
And let us know about it, too. How can this question be improved? I think this question has a really good intention and a really good goal and desire to get people to dive into the scriptures themselves, ask questions about it, really wrestle with it, maybe in a way that they haven't before. So
and
those are good intentions.
And it enables the other part of our intention was enabling people to recognize, to ask questions that weren't covered either in these questions or in the sermon, that you look at and you think, well, I don't understand that, and they haven't covered that in the questions, and Jonathan didn't say anything about it in the sermon, or David didn't say anything about it in the sermon. So it enables you as a group to engage with a question that maybe we didn't ask.
Yeah, and I found in our group as well, it really builds a familiarity with a passage before you get into discussing the questions. Mm. So everyone's going to have something, a little thing to say about the different parts of the passage. And then all of a sudden, oh, now we feel very at home and comfortable in this passage after doing so.
But if you prefer to move straight to question two, feel free to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay, well, let's do that now. Question two, righteous anger, ? James 1:20 says, the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Well, what about the anger of God? Did Jesus get angry? Did Paul? What makes anger sinful or righteous? Consider Cain as a case study.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question, because so often when we talk about anger, it is assumed to be a bad thing, mm-hmm. that you have an anger problem. You get too angry. And all of those things
are true. You have to go to anger management.
And all of those things are true, but it causes us sometimes to forget that anger is one of our emotions, and all of our emotions were given us by God. And therefore, it is the question is not, should we ever get angry? Because as the question points out, Jesus did get angry. He overturned the money tables.
Right.
And we hear about the wrath of God.
Sure.
It's not whether the emotion in itself is wrong. It's that so much of our lives is about, I think, learning how we bring our emotions under the lordship of Christ. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't matter. Love out of hand can cause problems.
Yeah.
And anger out of hand can cause problems. But love and anger, as God intended, and all the other emotions that we may have, as used as God intended them, are part of the rich tapestry of the life that God created for us.
And, I mean, just this idea of our emotions reflecting the emotions of our Creator.
Mm.
I think that's an important idea. That's reflected in the passage we're studying, too, in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus tells us, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." They shall have a similar character as their Father when they engage in peacemaking activities. And the last verse of chapter 5, with these antitheses, says, "You shall be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." So it's comparing your character, your righteousness, to that of the Father. You should be like Him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that's nice about these go-through questions, at least when I'm preaching, is that I can cover some material that I didn't get a chance to in the message. So I won't preach on the fact that there is a righteous anger. I'm just going to be addressing the sinful anger, I suppose, on Sunday morning. So this will give you a chance to talk about that. Our third question is called flea. Now, this is spelled with two E's, not E-A. We're not talking about a bug here. It's on your dogs. No, flea. Jesus suggests some bold strategies for dealing with lust. Tear out your metaphorical eye and cut off your metaphorical hand. What strategies did these Bible characters take or not take in combating lust? Consider Joseph, Samson, Job, David, Timothy. In our media-saturated society, you don't have to go looking for lust. Lust comes looking for you. Have you thought about your approach to resist this onslaught in today's highly sexualized culture?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Another important question that lust is always tends to be over-sexualized, a bit like our culture is. But the context of lust is a desire that is unhealthy in a sense. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be sexualized, but it is strongly sexualized.
It's a desire that's out of proportion with reality.
Right. And so, in a sense, the question enables us to think broader than the context, in as much as because the strategies that these guys take to either take or don't take
intentionally,
enable us to deal with not just the sexual desires that get out of hand, but the other sorts of desires, the other lusts that we have.
Right.
The lust for money, the lust for power, the lust for pleasure. All of those things.
Right.
Although not wrong in themselves any more than, you know, sex is a magnificent gift given us by God, but when it gets out of hand, And most of those things, I mean, somebody wrote a book, didn't they? Money, Sex, and Power. That most of those things, when they get out of hand, they get control of us. And that strategies to guard ourselves from something that gets control of us is so important.
And Paul says that we're not to be enslaved by anything. Mm. And, I mean, anyone who's been caught in the grips of pornography addiction will tell you that that's a slavery.
Oh, absolutely.
And a horribly dangerous one. I was listening to someone speak on this passage this last week in preparation for the sermon, and just thinking about this idea about how, I mean, the connection that Jesus makes between lust and adultery, and how adultery isn't going to happen just like that. It's going to happen as a result of a long, slow simmering over lustful thoughts. And I just like the way that this one pastor phrased his reflection on the sin of David with Bathsheba, and he supposed that David didn't wake up in the morning on the day when he saw Bathsheba bathing. He didn't wake up that morning and say, "You know what? Today's going to be the day that I will ruin the rest of my life." Mm. And in large part, that's what happened. If you read the book of 2 Samuel, after that moment, things aren't. They don't return to the level of peace and prosperity in David's kingdom as they were beforehand.
Right. And, you know, when you look at, when you contrast him with Joseph, who had, adultery put on a plate and offered him repeatedly. I mean, and David, I he didn't make that decision. Neither did he, I suspect, get up and say, "Huh, today's the day I'm going to commit adultery." But what he did was he let a, and maybe he didn't even expect to see Bathsheba in the swimming pool on her roof when he went to the window.
Right.
But he allowed that. He allowed that vision, that what he saw, to have house room in his head.
To take root.
And you know, we can see all sorts of things, not intending to see them. We can, you know, we can be encounter things without intending to encounter them. But do we let them have house room in our minds and all of those sorts of things? Mm. And I think that that's an interesting, when we look at these guys that you've put there, David, is the contrast between the way in which they allowed something to get hold of them and those that didn't.
Yeah. Well, for your listening pleasure, I want to read a quote for you from Martin Luther. It's kind of fantastic. He says, "I cannot keep a bird from flying over my head, but I certainly can keep it from making a nest in my hair and biting off my nose."
Yeah, that's great. That's a lovely quote.
So let's not have any nests in our hair, okay? Last question, question 4, original intent. In Matthew 19, the Pharisees wanted to talk about divorce, but Jesus wanted to talk about marriage. What do Matthew 19 and Malachi 2 teach about God's participation in the wedding ceremony? Have you experienced difficult seasons in your marriage, or the marriage of your parents or friends? How should God's faithfulness to his unfaithful bride, the church, motivate us to love as he loves us?
Now, yes, David, I know when we decided that you were going to preach on this particular passage, I thought to myself, well, this is a thorny issue, and it's because it is so much, has become so much part of our culture. And many people that I doubt that there's anybody in our church who hasn't had someone that they love affected by it. And so there's such an important way in which and the church has dealt with it in two really diverse ways. At one end, you've got the churches who sort of, like the Roman Catholic Church, that won't give you communion if you're divorced.
Right, it becomes an unforgivable sin.
It becomes an unforgivable sin. And then the other end of the church who says, oh, it really doesn't matter, you know, it's just, you know, it's just the way things are. And both of which don't actually engage with what God says about it. Now, divorce is one of the few things that Scripture tells us in one of the passages you've given us that God hates divorce. So how do you deal with that? And I think we deal with it by understanding, number one, why God hates divorce, but recognizing that he doesn't hate divorcees.
Yeah.
That he doesn't hate the people who have tragically got involved in it any more than he hates any other sinners.
Yeah. So true and so important, and I think encouraging for those who have experienced divorces personally in their lives. As a final note, I would just like to help you out on one of the aspects of this question. It asks about God's participation in the wedding ceremony. And when I was asking that, I just wanted to point to a couple of specific things. Firstly, Matthew 19 says, "What God joined together, let not man separate." So I see this as God actually ontologically doing something, being present, being the one who officiates the wedding ceremony, if you want to use that word. So he joins a man and a woman together in Matthew 19. And then in Malachi 2, it says that the Lord was witness. He was not only was he the officiant up on stage, but he was sitting in the pews as well. He was a witness between you and the wife of your youth. And it says here, "Did he not make them one?" And then this curious addition, "with the portion of the Spirit in their union." So
it's really pointing out how the primary protagonist in the selection and the joining together of two people is God. That we are enacting something that God is doing.
He's a romantic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is so exciting in so many ways.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I can, yeah, tell you that my wedding ceremony conducted by Jonathan was, yeah, one of the best days of my life. And to know that God had a part in that, that's an amazing thing.
It was a very special day in my life, too. I love performing that wedding. And yes, it was so clear that God was the architect. We were just the actors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think when we come to see how much of life that is true for, we really fall in line with the will of God.
Yeah, we do. Well, we hope you enjoy these questions and you enjoy, you know, really wrestling with what God is saying to us. Because we can't possibly, when Dave and I preach, we can't possibly deal with all of the aspects of it. But this gives you an opportunity to really wrestle with some of the things that God is saying to us, which will enable us to live in the way He calls us to live.
It's fully devoted
to Jesus. Absolutely.
As I wait.